So Genesis 29, verses 9 to 28, and we're going to call Brother Tom Lampe to come forward and lead us in that reading. Watchin' Lake Bible School, 2023. This is our third period teacher, Brother Carl Perry. The overall theme for the week is the life of Jacob. And the title of this class is Service in Haran. The reading was taken from Genesis chapter 29, verses 9 to 28. Brother Carl.
Thank you, Brother James, and good morning, brethren, sisters, and young people. It's nice to have some fans. Well, we left the previous study with one dominant thought in Jacob's life. He was alone, he was single, and yet God had promised him a glorious house, the house of God, Bethel, which would be extended far and wide beyond his wildest expectations. And in chapter 29 and verse 1, Jacob went on his journey, and you'll notice that the margin has, he lifted up his feet. It's almost like a renewed Jacob. He's got nearly 800 kilometers to go, but that's just in a verse. And off he goes. He indeed went on his way rejoicing. You know, brothers and sisters, the emphasis now of the record is going to be on the shaping of the house of God. And from now on, we're going to see an emphasis within God's work in that house. And that's why we have all of this domestic description, which on the surface seems like an awful tedious amount of information. But when we synthesize this, we're going to find, in fact, that God is at work in this circle. And you know, brothers and sisters, the hearth and the home more often than not becomes the place of destiny. In the domestic circle, God is at work in the actions and reactions of husband and wife, the interactions of the children, the daily chores of bringing up a family. In all of that, brothers and sisters, the words and the deeds and the interactions shape family life. And it's an important part of our experience as brothers and sisters in Christ, isn't it? An important part of that. And that's why there is this emphasis on all the family life through the patriarchs, and particularly the life of Jacob himself. God uses all the tensions and all the joys and circumstances of life to build a house of faith. The extraordinary is often seen in the ordinary. And God works like that at times, doesn't he? God is about to work in this house, and there indeed is much work to do. Now, we didn't read it this morning, but there's a great deal of information about shepherding in Syria. We read from verses 2 right through to verse 8, all these details about the shepherds in Syria. And you look at that and you think, well, why is that there? And I think the reason is, brethren and sisters, is because, you see, we're now introduced to a well in Syria. Now, Jacob had left Beersheba, the well of the oath, and he had now arrived in Syria, and it's a different kind of well. It's a different kind of hope. It's a different kind of way of salvation, because you see, a well represents the springs of life, doesn't it? And the divine narrative is just introducing us to the background into which Jacob is now stepping. The life-giving waters of the well in Syria is sealed. There's no free access to the well of salvation like there was back in Beersheba. The flocks are in desperate need of water and pasture, but there is no desire by these Syrian shepherds to actually feed and water the flock. In fact, they're hanging around, waiting for somebody to come to open the well and to give the flocks their desired water. The shepherds are lazy, the shepherds are indolent. It made little sense to Jacob why they were just hanging around, waiting for someone to actually move the stone, when the shepherds themselves could do that. In fact, it only took one man to move the stone. That was Jacob. This is Syria. This is religion outside the well of the oath. The customs of the land prevented the shepherds from giving water. It's just like our church system today. The well is closed. The so-called shepherds of the church are lazy and indolent, and there is no water. It needs somebody else, someone from Beersheba, to come and give life. And that's the environment he's stepping into. The fact that there were male shepherds in this area, and Rachel comes along, who's of course a female, indicates that as far as Laban was concerned, the women can do the shepherding. That was his emphasis on shepherding. We know that God takes a great deal of interest in shepherds. The development of David, for example, in caring and looking after the flock. Long hours, hard work. That was given to Rachel. These few sheep, said Jacob later on. It was a miserable flock. No water, indolent shepherds. And in steps Jacob. And he's absolutely amazed. I mean, sure, it makes more sense to open the well, give them the flocks water, send them back to pasture, and allow them to develop and feed properly. And that's exactly what he did. Do you know Laban, he said in verse 5. And they said, yes, we know Laban, and here comes his daughter. In verse 9, while he yet spake with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them or pastured them. She didn't even have authority over those sheep. It was Laban's sheep. He owns everything. And we are introduced in verse 10 to Laban. It came to pass when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob went near. So once again, we have this emphasis on Syria, the link between Laban and the family likeness. And that family likeness is about to come to the fore. Laban. His name means white. And he was the most black-hearted man you can imagine. The first reference to Laban occurs in chapter 24. We're not going to turn to that. Was when Isaac, Abraham's servant Eliezer came into the camp with the wealth. And the record says that when Laban saw all this wealth, he was more than happy to negotiate a wife for Isaac. So we're introduced into this circle of covetousness. That's Laban. We find, of course, that he deceived Jacob on his wedding night. We'll look at that in a moment. We find, in fact, that he made it impossible for Jacob to gain wealth. We'll see that in a moment, too. He continually changed the terms of employment. And finally, he robbed his own daughters blind. Who'd like a father like that? That's Laban. Callous, indifferent to everything. And here he is, about to influence the life of Jacob, and Jacob having to put up with that kind of person. Indeed, the well is dry in Syria. So he rolls away the rock. There's a diligence there. If you want the waters of salvation, brethren and sisters, you have to show zeal and you have to show diligence. You know, Paul said in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6, that without faith it's impossible to please God. For he that cometh to God must believe that he exists, he is, and that he's a rewarder of them who diligently seek him. Not just seek him, not just be a Christadelphian in name, diligently seek him. And that word diligence occurs three times in the second epistle of Peter. Give diligence to add to your faith virtue. Give diligence to make your calling and election sure. Be diligent that you may be found in Christ in peace. Diligence, brothers and sisters. We saw last night that zeal is in fact a quality of the saints in immortality, and it should be a quality of us now. We just can't float in and out of the truth, Benson. We just can't float in the meeting without contributing and serving and helping. Diligence with our children, with our family, with those we come in contact with. And that's the zeal and diligence that Jacob had in rolling that stone away to provide water, the water of salvation. Now in verse 11, we have the meeting between Jacob and Rachel. Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. What a meeting that is. You imagine Rachel, she's standing there. This man comes from far, rolls the stone away, that has the customary greeting of kissing, and all of a sudden he bursts out crying. He is 57 years old, and he's bursting out crying. And Rachel would have been wondering, what have I met here? But I think, brothers and sisters, that in that we see the sensitivity of Jacob. the relief. I mean, he's arrived with a great conflict of emotions. What will I experience in Syria? I'm 800 kilometers from home. I'm here because of the deceit that I practiced upon my family. And yet, knowing the lessons of Eliezer finding a wife for his father, that there's a hope and expectation that he will find something. And here this woman is. And the record says he saw her and the flock. He's a pastoralist. He knows sheep. And he finds that this woman is related to the family. And I think that sense of overwhelming emotions, of relief and yet guilt, now washing over him. And he just collapses in weeping. You know, it's a really interesting picture when you think about that. A really interesting picture. And in verse 12, he tells her. She listens. She runs back and tells her father. She's active, isn't she? She doesn't sort of dawdle back or takes her time. She runs back. She is an active woman. And Jacob would be amazed at that. So imagine meeting a girl. You burst out crying and she runs away. Not a good introduction, is it? But, of course, Laban listens to the tidings which Rachel had. And Laban is more than enthusiastic. Verse 13, when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him. So there's enthusiasm here in the group. Embraced him and kissed him, brought him to his house. And I want you to notice at the end of verse 13, and Jacob told Laban all these things. Now, I think, brothers and sisters, that in that discussion, Jacob would have explained to Laban why he is there. He told him all these things. And I think that he would have explained the reason why he's there. And I think it's a confession of sorts. He would have explained in all honesty and in openness that he had deceived his father. The promise of the elder and the younger. And the reason why I say that is because you see the calculating manipulation of Laban introduces elder and younger in all of this record. And he wouldn't have got that out of the air. He took advantage of this confession. That's the kind of man he is. The kind of man that will manipulate for gain. He told Laban all these things. And Laban, in listening to that and understanding that, made a connection. You know, you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. That's the language of marriage. You know, we are united. We are family. And despite all of those incidents that have happened, you're with me, Jacob. You're with me. And I think Jacob would have felt a sense of security, not knowing really the depth of the blackness of this white man. And he's head over heels in love. 57 years old, head over heels in love. What a wonderful story that is. You see, because Laban had two daughters in verse 16. The name of the elder was Leah, the name of the younger was Rachel. And whenever you see in the scripture the name of, is inviting you to look deeper into the meaning of the names. Rachel. Her name means weary. Often the names of children are a reflection of the parents at the time. I mean, the child has no choice in naming itself. And I think weary would have been a reflection perhaps of Laban's life at this time. He had a small flock. He was just a bit of an unknown entity in that region. We don't know precisely. But at the time she was born, he was weary. And the name of the young was Rachel. Rachel means ewe, E-W-E, it's a young lamb. But the character is significant in verse 17. Leah was tender-eyed. The eyes, the light of the body, a symbol of the intelligence, of understanding, of a way of thinking. And the record is saying that her disposition is one of tenderness and gentleness. And Rachel, she was beautiful and well-favored. And this is highlighted to suggest that the reason why Jacob was drawn to this woman was her good looks. He is repeating the mistake of his father, Isaac, who made an assessment of his son based on his senses. Now, young brethren and young sisters, the basis of a marriage is more than just outward attraction. Yes, attraction is important. You have to like the person that you are attracted to, but it must go deeper. And just because we marry another Christadelphian does not mean the marriage is going to be automatically successful. The basis of a good marriage is the same ideals, the same approach to the truth, the same unity of thinking about bringing up children and a home and developing a oneness together in the things that matter, a united front. That's the basis of attraction. It must be deeper than just physical attraction. Jacob made that mistake. Leah was a sensitive, tender, gentle woman. Her characteristics were emphasized through her eyes. But it was the beauty of Rachel that was the basis of the attraction. And it caused enormous problems in this relationship. He agreed because of the love that he had for her, Rachel, thy younger daughter. Notice the emphasis in verse 16, the name of the elder, the name of the younger. We're introduced, we're being set up in the record for this complexity of elder and younger. This is the basis upon which Jacob's deception occurred. You know, what's interesting is Laban's reaction to this. I mean, Jacob comes to Laban and says, look, I'm head over heels in love. I love your daughter, and I'm prepared to work 7 years for her. And, you know, any decent father would have said, well, congratulations, that's lovely, that's wonderful. I'm thrilled that we can embrace you into the family. You know, verse 19, well, I suppose it's better that you have her than somebody else has her. And, 7 years, that's a good deal. Now, this is the kind of man he is. There is zero empathy. It's transactional. And that's the kind of man that he is. So, we know the story, don't we? Those days went just like lightning. 7 years was nothing for the love that he felt for Rachel. He was working out of love. And the wedding took place. There's a great ceremony. And in verse 23, it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went in unto her. Apparently, it was the custom in those days at the end of the wedding ceremony, when it was dark, was to produce the bride. She was covered from head to toe in a veil and presented to her husband. So Jacob wouldn't recognize her. And the record says in verse 25, it came to pass in the morning, behold. And that word is there because of the striking shock to the system. In the Hebrew, she, Leah. And you can imagine the shock of that. Looking forward to the conjugal bed with his beloved. And the next morning, the shock of that it's a different woman. You know, it raises the question, doesn't it, about the complicity of Rachel and Leah in this arrangement. There was no protest from any of them, nor comment from any of them, either one way or the other. And I think the reason for that is that they couldn't say anything because they were totally, absolutely totally at the disposal of their autocratic and deceitful father. And I think the scriptural reason behind that is that in verse 25, who does he blame? He blames Laban. He doesn't blame Leah. He doesn't blame Rachel. What is this that thou hast done to me? Do not I deserve serve thee for Rachel? Wherefore hast thou beguiled me? And that word beguiled is the same word used back in the previous chapters where Esau said of Jacob that he has deceived me. So the divine irony is now turning full circle. But The blame goes to Laban because Jacob understood it was his manipulation. And we find in verse 27 that when the next transaction takes place, you know, we read in verse 27, "Fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve with me yet 7 other years. I'm going to read you Young's literal translation of that verse. "Fulfill the week of this one, then must we give the other one." Now, this is a father talking. It's not Leah, Rachel, or my lovely daughter, or my wonderful daughter. It's this one and that one. This is the transactional nature of Laban. He had full control of these women. They had no say in the arrangement. And therefore, Jacob didn't blame any of those women for their complicity. They weren't involved. They couldn't be involved. He had complete control of his daughters. And the tragedy of that becomes apparent. "Why hast thou beguiled me?" And we all know the reason why. Just as Rebekah disguises her younger son and makes him look like an older brother, so Laban, under the cover of night, introduces the older instead of the younger to Jacob's tent. The word beguile, as I mentioned before in chapter 27, verse 35, is precisely the word used of the subtlety of Jacob. The supplanter has been supplanted. Now, I want you to think providentially about this. If this had happened to you, what would you do? Multiple wives are permitted. This is the wife that providentially God has given you. Now, you can do one of two things. You can accept that providential decision, and you can believe that this tender woman has been given through providence, even through its manipulation, and you can stay with her and make her your one wife. Or you can be trapped by your emotions to take the second wife. And Jacob chose the second. Not an easy decision, is it? "Why hast thou beguiled me?" Verse 26, Laban said, "It must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn." And that very language betrays the fact that Laban knew precisely from Jacob's description what had happened back there. And he took advantage of that, manipulated that, elder and younger. Now, I'd like you to come to Hosea chapter 12. You see, we have a divine principle here being outworked. And it's a divine principle that goes all through our life as well as Jacob's life. Hosea chapter 12. Verse 2. "Yahweh hath also a controversy with Judah and will punish Jacob," or the Hebrew says, "visit upon Jacob, according to his ways. According to his doings will he recompense him." And then it goes on at the life of Jacob. We'll look at these verses later on in further studies. But I want you to notice that God visits Jacob according to his ways and will recompense him according to his doings. He had deceived. He had deceived his father. He was now being deceived by a greater deceiver. And this principle, brothers and sisters, goes all the way through our life. Come to Jeremiah 17. I don't think we think much about this, but Brother David mentioned that in his first talk about the effect of disease upon the Corinthian ecclesia because they weren't, in fact, separating the Lord's body in their memorial meeting. There was a consequence of their behavior. Now, in Jeremiah 17, look at these two verses. Verse 9. "The heart is deceitful above all things, desperately sick," as the Hebrew is. "Who can know it? We have trouble discerning our motives. Who can know it?" God does in verse 10. I, Yahweh, search the heart," that's your understanding. "I test the reins," and that's the kidneys, which is the affections and your emotions. "For what purpose? To give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. And you'll find, brothers and sisters, that the divine wheel of irony frequently visits our life. We might be doing something which is wrong, and 5, 10 years later, that divine wheel of divine justice comes back to us, and all of a sudden we realize that this is deja vu. This is a circumstance that I've been in before. Or a circumstance that's going to actually do something to hurt us because we've hurt somebody else. And so the record is saying that God searches our heart. He sees the deficiencies. He understands the emotions, and he's going to actually bring the fruit of our doings into display. So if we are brethren and sisters who agitate and backbite, you will find in your life that someone will do that to you. You'll feel the hurt of that as the hurt that you've caused other people. And it works the other way too, that if you're a brother and sister who is generous, you'll find that the generosity will be given back to you. The fruit of the doings is rewarded. That's precisely what Hosea was saying. I'm going to visit Jacob according to his ways, and according to his doings, I will recompense him. And the reason for that is, it's not that God seeks some type of vengeance, but he's trying to educate us that the behavior that we have to each other, you will feel that behavior yourself, to learn. And if that behavior is hurting you, then learn that as well. Change. That's the reason for that. The divine wheel of change. But it's only, brothers and sisters, it's only valuable if our senses are exercised. That's the point of Paul in Hebrews, isn't it? That trial, affliction, the wheel of divine irony has to exercise our thought. Why is that happening? Oh, I've done that to somebody else. And while the sense is being exercised, we, brothers and sisters, are fully aware of the purpose of those trials. So let's come back to Genesis chapter 29. God rewards us according to the fruit of our doings. Our behavior to others, we will be on the receiving end of that similar behavior, for good or ill, that we may learn righteousness and godliness. So, verse 27. Laban has a solution to the problem. Of course he has a solution to the problem. This is part of the manipulation. Fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for service. It's a this one. So the week here is the marriage arrangements for Leah. So let's go through the wedding arrangements. Let's go through the ceremonies. And after 7 days, we'll make sure you get Rachel. How callous is this? How do you think Jacob and Rachel and Leah think in all of this arrangement? How do you think Leah felt in all this arrangement? Cast off by the husband the next morning. And then 7 days later, he gets a second wife. It's awful, isn't it? Absolutely awful. The emotions will be running so high that it's almost disruptive to everything in that family life. Now, how is God in his providence going to work now with this arrangement? We've got two sisters. The record says in Genesis chapter 29, verse 30, he went into Rachel also, and he loved her also more than Leah, and served him yet 7 other years. So we now have tension in the marriage. A wife he doesn't really want, and a wife whom he loves, and they're sisters. Sisters. Close bond. And God is now going to work in this arrangement in a wonderful way to change Leah, to change Rachel, and to change Jacob. And even though Jacob favored Rachel more than Leah, in fact, the context here, love less is defined as hated in this context. Not always so, but in this context, God is seeking a habitation to dwell in, a house of faith, and he's got a huge amount of work to do. And that's why we have this tremendous, almost seemingly detailed description of these conceptions and births, because God is now going to work in childbirth to change this family, and he does so over the years. And when the record says in verse 30 that he loved Rachel more than Leah, he still loved Leah after sorts. I mean, they shared the conjugal bed, but that was nothing compared to the love he had for Rachel. And over time, Leah felt this willful neglect. Every time Jacob looked at Leah, he would have seen in her the deceit of Laban, the deception. He would understand that he'd been tricked. And you imagine the wife knowing that she was used as a tool of manipulation. The elder and the younger sister are competing for a single husband. And this is setting the scene for the heartache and the tension of the family. And God's going to work with all of that. And it is his work. Come across to Isaiah 44. I will make thee. I will do the work. And we're so glad that that's the case, both in his life and ours. Isaiah 44, verse 1. Yet now hear, O Jacob, my servant, and Israel, whom I have chosen. Thus saith Yahweh that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, and thou, Jeshurun, whom I have chosen. So God goes to the nation, and he says, I have made you, I have formed you, starting from the womb. That's why all of these conceptions in Genesis chapter 30 and 31 are so important, because it is God making from the womb. Verse 21, remember these, O Jacob and Israel, for thou art my servant. I have formed thee. Thou art my servant, O Israel. Thou shalt not be forgotten at me. The fashioner, the creator, the maker is now going to start at work from the womb. And he's going to build a house of faith. It's an incredible work when you think about it. And that same work is happening with us. You know, it comes out in little words. You know, when Jesus chose his disciples, he said, I will make you to become fishers of men. The work is the Lord's. And we are very thankful that with all our idiosyncrasies, our complexities, our proclivities to sin, our bias to sin, God is at work. And we should yield to that work, perceive that. Now, we are introduced to Leah as a godly woman. She's God-conscious. She's a woman who's loved less by her husband. We see that she is later afflicted by her husband, by her sister. And though she is the first and legitimate wife, she feels that Rachel has stolen Jacob's affections. And all she seeks is to be loved and respected by her husband. You know, I'm not a woman, but I can understand a woman feeling the need for love and affection and to be noticed and to be appreciated. All women are like that, aren't they? And the desperate position that she's in, God was aware of that. Verse 31 of chapter 29. And when Yahweh saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Now, I think that's an amazing verse. God is not oblivious, brothers and sisters, to our trials and to our afflictions, and he's going to respond with comfort and care at the time of need. I want you to see the deliberate providence of this. He saw a wife in affliction, and he saw another wife over here, and he left one deliberately barren, and he gave the other children. Now, this is the work of God. It's God working in the family, and immediately it seems to be creating tension, isn't it? It's going to create tension. But in that adversity, God's working is going to occur. God left Rachel barren, not as a punishment, but eventually to bring circumstances to bear that would make her turn to God. Because we find in Rachel that there is a lack of God awareness until finally towards the end. So let's look at the way God first works with Leah. God begins to do to Leah things he would not do for Rachel. He begins to build the house of Jacob with Leah. She bore four children in succession, quick succession. And of those four children, two would form the pillars of the future nation, Levi and Judah. Now, I want you to look at the response to these conceptions and these births. Three out of the four births, Leah has a complete recognition that God is at work. Look at verse 32. Leah conceived and bare a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, "Surely Yahweh hath looked upon my affliction. Therefore now my husband will love me." See, Yahweh, not God, not Elohim, not El Shaddai, Yahweh, the covenant God. She is in a relationship with the Father, and she sees and prays to him. Verse 33, she conceived again and bare a son and said, "Because Yahweh hath heard that I was hated, he hath therefore given me this also." She understood, and the only way she could understood that is if she went to God in prayer and received an answer from God. But I think it's the last son which really is wonderful for this woman. You see, in verse 34, she conceived again and bare a son and said, "Now, this time my husband will love me, will be joined to me, because I have borne him three sons." You know, how sad that is. How sad that is. Now surely, after the third son, surely my husband will be joined to me. But it's the fourth boy, which I think is a wonderful assessment from Leah. She conceived again and bare a son, and she said, "Now will I praise Yahweh." Therefore she called his name Judah and left bearing. The first three sons were an agonizing request to be appreciated by her husband. But the fourth one is praise to Almighty God without a reference to her husband. And she came to recognize, brothers and sisters, that to be loved and to be recognized by Almighty God, Yahweh Elohim of Israel, was a far greater thing than to be loved by a husband. And that's the implication, isn't it? In the first three, my husband, my husband, my husband. In the fourth child, I will praise Yahweh. And I think, brothers and sisters, that is a testimony to the wonderful focus of this relationship that Leah had developed in that fourth child. She could offer praise independent of what her husband thought. That's the change that God wrought in her. And it took four births to achieve that. And you know, brothers and sisters, I think for our sisters, it's an important thing, isn't it, that our relationship as a sister with Almighty God is an important part of married life. But it needs to be a strong relationship. It needs to be one which can find consolation and the wonder of comfort with God in adversity, to have that strong relationship. And Leah, in the end, had that wonderful relationship with the Father. But, you know, the lessons didn't end there. In chapter 30 and verse 1, when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister. So now this wonderful sense of closeness to God is now threatened now by the envy of her sister. Envy is one of those emotions of the flesh that's condemned by the scriptures. Who can stand before envy and jealousy? Jealousy is as cruel as the grave, says the Proverbs. It is a powerful emotion, and if it gets hold of us, we are in serious trouble. We are focused in anger and envy at something else, with all the exclusion of everything else, including God. And all we can think about, our thoughts are dominated, how that individual is better than us. And that consumes us. We can't afford to be in that situation. And in chapter 30, verse 8, Rachel says, "With great wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister." And if you have a marginal reference, you'll see there, "With the wrestlings of God have I wrestled with my sister." So this is a tug of war. This is almost open warfare between these two sisters. wrestling, as it were, the wrestlings of God. That's how strong these things were happening. And if that's not bad enough, we have this awful interchange in verses 14 to 18 of chapter 30 over mandrakes. Now these mandrakes were some type of vegetable, some type of berry that was supposed to, in the mind of people, do two things. One, they were considered to be an aphrodisiac. And two, they were believed to enhance the chances of conception. So two different effects. Leah wanted them because she craved Jacob's love. Rachel needed them because she needed to conceive. Now think of the family dynamics. Reuben, who's obviously a teenager by here, comes in with this aphrodisiac, this plant that's supposed to give conception. He knows the power of this plant, at least psychologically, if not physically. He knows his mother's plight. He knows that Jacob has less desire for his mother than for the other wife. And if Reuben knew that, then the other children who were of age would also know that as well. And the problem is being magnified through the household. And if that isn't enough, the news goes around the camp about these mandrakes, and Rachel hears. And then Rachel and Leah begin to argue and to bargain over access to Jacob for the night. Can you imagine that? One was desperate to conceive. One was desperate for the husband lover. And eventually Leah managed to, in fact, conceive that night. She shamelessly had to beg Jacob for that conjugal bed. But in verse 17, she said, God hearkened unto Leah, and she conceived. The difference between Rachel and Leah at this point is that Leah is consulting Almighty God. Rachel is not yet at that position. The sixth and the final son, she didn't have to beg for Jacob's attention. He was naturally spending more time with her as a husband. In verse 20, Leah said, God hath endued me with a good dowry. Now will my husband dwell with me, because I have borne him six sons. And she called his name Zebulun. This time my husband dwells with me. At last. At last. She felt connected to her husband, respected by him, loved as a wife. And that was God's gift to her. She recognized that. And that's how God developed Leah's spirituality through all that heartache. Sisters, could you go through that? And come out the other end of that having a godly disposition or a bitter disposition. And now God's got to work with Rachel. So let's see how God is working with the other sister. Now you can imagine Rachel. She is the love wife. And the other wife, her sister, 1, 2, 3, 4 children. No problems. And hence the envy of chapter 30 and verse 1. Her sister. She couldn't even call her Leah, her sister. Rachel felt threatened by that. I'm the one whom Jacob loves, and yet my sister's given 4 children. Jealousy is as cruel as the grave. Now, I want you to look at a reaction in chapter 30, verse 1. Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, give me children, or else I die. Now that is irrational request. God had caused the barrenness. But she turns to her husband in absolute frustration. Give me children, or else I die. You know, brothers and sisters, she died giving birth to the second child. Be careful what you wish for. Now in verse 2, we have Jacob's reaction. Now, this is to the wife whom he loved. And Jacob's anger was kindled against Rachel, and he said, am I in God's stead, who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? Why does a husband who loves his wife become greatly angry? And I think, brothers and sisters, he realized that she was asking of him something that he couldn't give. And that love that he had for her became one of anger. But he knows that God has withheld her from bearing. So he is aware providentially that God is working with his wife, not producing children, and that it is a work of God. Now, how he knew that, we don't know. Am I in God's stead? Am I like God, he said? And what he was doing was, in that display of anger, was actually trying to get through to Rachel that God is involved in this work. He believed the promise of God. Rachel, I'm not in God's stead. And I think that began to work in Rachel's mind. And from here on, we're going to see a subtle change until we have a final change. Leah put God first, but Rachel put Jacob in God's place. She hasn't yet made that transition. So the next best thing was to do what Sarah did, and she gave Jacob a concubine. Now Jacob could have said no. I mean he knew the dangers. I mean, he's got two competing wives, and now we've got a third and a fourth. But how could he resist? How could he resist his wife? Child of a concubine was considered to be the child of the wife itself. So he's going to add another dimension of problem to the family for his wife's sake. And you know, this time round there is a change. Verse 6, Rachel said, God hath judged me and hath also heard my voice and given me a son. Now that's interesting. She brought God into the equation. She herself couldn't conceive, but through her handmaid, there was conception. God has heard my voice. So the multiple births of her sister, the envy that she's developed, the rebuke from the husband has now turned her providentially to God. She's being exercised by these trials, and she's now praying to God. Well, Bilhah gave a second child, and unfortunately the same feelings began to emerge once again. So she's struggling. See, verse 8, Rachel said, with the wrestlings of God have I wrestled with my sister, but I've won, I've prevailed, I'm vindicated. What an unsisterly attitude that was. It was all about winning against Leah. This is very much like Jacob. It got to win on all costs. But she was wrestling. Like Esau and Jacob in the womb, like a wrestling match we're going to see later on with the angel. And can you imagine Leah listening to that? I'm wrestling with you, Leah. I'm fighting you, Leah. I'm struggling with you, Leah. But I'm winning. I'm winning. But she still was unable to bear children. My handmaid can, but I can't. And that would have immediately told her that the problem is with her. Not with Jacob. Jacob can cause conception. It'll work with the handmaid, but it won't work with me. And I think Ben says after the birth of that second child, it would have been very introspective as she's now examining her own life. Why can't she conceive? And it must be providential, and it can only be of God. And so in chapter 30 and verse 22, the record says God remembered Rachel and God hearkened to her and opened her womb. At last, Rachel has turned to God in sincere prayer, and in God's mercy, he listened to that appeal. He saw the dynamics of the family. He understood what was going on, and now was the time. Now was the time, the right time, to give her that child. She was now turning Godward. And in verse 23, she conceived and bare a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. Here's her acknowledgement. Here's her recognition that God had a part in her life. And that's the wonderful thing about the change that occurred in Rachel. At last. And she believed that that was the beginning of another part of the family. So she said, and notice the word, Yahweh shall add to me another son. God has now become Yahweh. Her relationship has now been cemented with the covenant God. She's buoyed by the prospect that God had listened to her. She's a changed woman. When you look at the dynamics of the two sisters and of Jacob later on in the record, we find that all of these arrangements, in fact, brought the sisters closer together in the end. You see, in chapter 31 and verse 4, let's come across to that. When the decision is made to leave Syria, verse 4 of chapter 31, Jacob said and called Rachel and Leah. He didn't just call one wife, he called them both. He brings both wives together to explain his predicament. He sees them as equals now. In chapter 31, verse 14, Rachel and Leah answered Jacob and said, "Is there yet any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not counted as strangers? He sold us and hath quite devoured also our money." They were in a common lot. Together they expressed the same concern. God had brought them together. And they both said, "Whatsoever God has said to you, Jacob, do." And I think that little hint towards the end of the family demonstrates, brothers and sisters, that they're together. All of those circumstances, all of that grief, all of that tension, all of that wrestling and envy is gone. They're together, expressing decisions together. And Jacob calls them together. Now that's God working with Rachel. That's God working with Leah. Now how is God going to work with Jacob? Well, Jacob's in the middle of all of this seeming turmoil, isn't he? He's not divorced from all that tension. He's angry at certain points because of Rachel's behavior. But independently of all of that family tension, which God is bringing these women to a relationship with himself, he's now also going to work in Jacob's life. From the record, it would appear that Jacob was in Syria for 40 years. 20 years working with Laban and 20 years working for Laban. We haven't got time to prove that this morning, but in those 40 years, and 40 of course is the number of probation, he has been subjected to awful deception. He has borne many adversities day and night. Any lost animals, he replaces them out of his own pocket. He suffered constant pay changes. Brethren, if you've been in that environment, you know how frustrating that is. And he bore all of this adversity, all of this maliciousness and manipulation by Laban for year after year after year after year. He's being deceived, he's being taken advantage of, he's being defrauded. And there is not one single word of complaint. This is a different man than the deceiver back in his own family camp in Beersheba. Trial and adversity by God over many years is changing this man. It's precisely what's happening to Jacob. And then when Joseph is born, in chapter 31 and verse 25, so that's the wrong reference there. When Joseph is born, Jacob realizes now that he has to make a decision. He's got a family of 11 boys. He's got two wives and two concubines, and he has nothing, absolutely zero. No money in the bank. No wealth. It's all Laban's. And I think he realized at that point, with Joseph being born, that it was time to reevaluate where he stood, and it was time to come home. Nearly 40 years was about to expire. Looking at what he had, he realized that that's not going to work. So in chapter 30, that's the reference, chapter 30, verse 25, it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away." So he has to negotiate this deal with Laban. So Laban says in chapter 30 and verse 31, "What shall I give thee? You want to leave? let me give you something. Now, you know, I think if we'd been in that position, we would have said, well, look, I think I need a couple of thousand dollars in the bank. I think a loan would be nice, or a free gift, or perhaps some of your flocks. Do you know what Jacob's answer was in verse 31? Thou shalt not give me anything. Now, in that verse is a dramatic change to the heel catcher. The man who wants to grasp, to deceive, to take what's his own through deceit, trickery and subtlety, now says to Laban, I don't want anything from you. Now, this is an entirely different man, entirely different. And trial and adversity will change our perceptions, change our character, and change our values and priorities. Oh, it should. You might come in the truth, loving sport. Well, 5-10 years of adversity and access to the Word of God is going to change your perception on sport, or should. Exactly what happened here with Jacob. I don't want anything. A little bit like Abraham to the king of Solomon. I don't want anything from you. So I'm prepared to give you extra service. And the plan will be simple. We have a great flock here. It's your flock, Laban. I recognize that. But all I want is those animals that have black and white spots or speckled. Now, that's an interesting request. Most of the herds today in the region of Syria are generally either black or they're white. So Laban thinks, right, that's a good deal, because most of my flock would not have that speckled look, that spotted look, that variegated colour. And do you know what Laban did? He deliberately removed all the speckled and spotted flock and pushed them 3 days' journey from Jacob, so he had no chance of breeding from black or white sheep, speckled or spotted sheep. How's that for manipulation? He reduced the gene pool. He took out everything that would give any advantage to Jacob. That's Laban. Yes, says Laban, great deal. Great deal. Now, what you notice in verse 33, a term that Jacob now begins to use. So shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come. You know, there's integrity now in Jacob. There's a good conscience now in Jacob. It's my righteousness. We're going to see actually that God will deal with that a bit later on. But Jacob comes to the fore a little bit initially. So what he does, he has this plan to be able to influence the gestation of these animals. And you know, we look at this, and he's got special rods of trees here and special branches there, and he's got them in the water troughs. And we look at that and we think, what on earth are you doing, Jacob? But I was reading an article, and it was talking about, from a scientific perspective, that these branches of particular trees were known for their medicinal properties. Some of them would cure urogenital problems, reduce fevers. They were anti-inflammatories. So there's a little bit of science, I think, behind what he was trying to do. He was trying to reduce the failure of conception of these animals. But it's Jacob. It's Jacob. It's Jacob. He wants to do that. It's resurfacing again, isn't it? The grasping, the manipulation, the trying to do things under his control and his power. But when we come to chapter 31, we find, in fact, that God appears to Jacob and corrects this understanding. You see, what was happening was that as the years went by, Laban said, this year I'm going to take all the spotted animals. And that year it just happened to happen that spotted animals were conceived. So next year Jacob says, okay, I'm going to have all the striped animals. And that year all the animals were striped. And Laban changed again and said, well, third year I'm going to have speckled. And sure enough, that year all the animals were speckled. And that would have a deep impression on Jacob. There's something happening here that is out of my control. And we find, in fact, that when we come to chapter 31, look at verse 5. Jacob says to his wives, I see your father's countenance, that it's not toward me as before, but the God of my father hath been with me. So he's beginning to understand providential interference here. In verse 7, your father has deceived me, changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. I've been protected. In verse 8, if he said, the speckled shall be thy wages, then all the cattle bear speckled. If he said, the ring straight shall be thy hire, then all the cattle will ring straight. Thus God hath taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. God has done this. In verse 12, lift up now thine eyes and see all the rams which leap upon the cattle are ring straight, speckled and grizzled, for God says, I have seen all that Laban doth unto thee. So what's happening is that year by year, Jacob's noticing this pattern, and he suddenly realizes that God is at work with him. And then God in a vision comes to him and says, Jacob, I have done that. I've done that. And this time, Jacob is fully conscious that it's not through his own manipulation, his own heel grasping, that he's done these things. It is in fact a work of God. God was at work. It was time to go home. And now this family was going to emerge for a different journey. But the work of developing the house had only just started. But the wonderful thing is that in all of that distress, changing of wages and manipulation by a deceitful man, God emerges from the fall. And this is the new power in their lives. It's going to be tested in the next phase of their life. But God has so wonderfully, through adversity, brought all these three people, Leah, Rachel and Jacob, to the same conclusion that God is at work in this house. And you know, brothers and sisters, our final point is this, that if God is going to those lengths to introduce that kind of adversity to change those people, how much more is he going to do it in our lives too? We are not going to be immune from trial and tribulation. None of us are. It'll come in different directions, in different ways, in different intensity. God knows precisely what we need. The pressure points, he knows precisely what pressure to put upon us. And in all of that adversity, brothers and sisters, we can have this absolute confidence that God is working in our lives to produce this end result. He is ministering abundantly an entrance into the kingdom of God. The way will not be easy. The way will be full of tension and difficulty, even perhaps within families as well. But in the end, the wonderful thing of great consolation is our God is at work to get us into that kingdom.